football on Off the Ball.
So he brought Max Damon on, who's not 16 until December, by the way. It's sort of ridiculous. I can't really explain it, to see a 15-year-old come on and do what he did.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast
with UPMC Sports Surgery Clinic. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
Delighted now to be joined by our own favourite football writer and broadcaster, Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan, good morning.
Morning, how are you doing?
Are you aware of the tension between Roy Keane and Keith Andrews? I don't know if you heard us there just before we went to the ad break, but we're saying from an Irish perspective, we anticipated there might have been a bit of tension with Roy Keane and punditry. And I was saying from the British side of things, maybe what Roy Keane said about Keith Andrews yesterday was no big deal, where it was Keith talks a good game and now it's time to walk that talk.
But I actually have to say I didn't hear him say that, because I was at the United Arsenal game and I was on the train back, so I haven't seen anything of what Roy Keane said. So he was sort of saying that Keith Andrews is very good at talking about the game, but maybe not necessarily the best applicator for that.
Yeah, that's pretty much fair summary. He left it open to be finished off by Keith Andrews himself. But again, like, this is of particular interest for us, that he talked about him, Jonathan, for about maybe 60 seconds on Sky and repeatedly said in that 1 minute, this is a huge opportunity for Keith. He must have said it four times, that he kept going back to, this is a huge opportunity for Keith. He talks a very good game, yeah. and he always has done.
And he did it in that typical Roy Keane tone where you can't tell that he's being sarcastic. But if you know, you know. It's like, oh, it's a big opportunity for him. Yeah, he's a great fella. Yeah, talks a great game.
I guess this is going to be a ridiculous baptism of fire for Keith Andrews regardless, but the Roy Keane added factor is maybe something that would surprise a lot of people outside of Ireland.
Yeah, I have to say, I wasn't aware of that. But I think it's obvious to everybody that this is the big step up. I think there's always a slight concern when anybody who's been in the background at a club becomes the number one, that I think that change of role can often be quite awkward, can often be quite difficult. That perhaps, I think the lower down the sort of coaching scale you are at a club, the more your job is to be sort of liaison between the players and the top tier. I don't really know if that was the case with Keith Andrews at Brentford, but I think to change role, it's not always easy. I think the fact that he has no experience as a frontline manager, there's always going to be doubts about him. And I think a lot of people looking this season saying, can any of the three promoted sides stay up? Part of the question is, are they any good? But also, which of the 17 might slip down? And I think for most people, Brentford are the 17th of the 17, because they've lost Mbeumo, they've lost Norgaard, it looks like Wisser might be leaving, they've lost Flecken. I mean, I think Keller's a perfectly good replacement, but still, losing your goalkeeper, changing your goalkeeper is a change. And of course, losing Thomas Frank, who has done such a good job there. And I think, you know, Brentford are one of those clubs, they got the 19th biggest wage bill in the Premier League last season, so massively overperformed, as they've done consistently. But the way you do that is to get every element of that club pulling in the right direction, that every element of that club works. And so they, you know, for instance, that front three, it wasn't an orthodox front three last season with Mbeumo and Wisser and Chada, but they all made each other better. And Thomas Frank, I think, was somebody who could see that. I think he was somebody who got the best out of players. And you take any element out of that, and there's a risk it falls apart. To take out three or four elements, particularly the biggest element, who is Frank, and you know, there's always going to be doubts, particularly when there's not a huge amount of money to try and replenish the squad.
In your experience of covering this type of situation, what happens next now for Keith Andrews in the second game? Does he change tact completely, and is there a bit of panic set in when you're a first-time manager and your first job happens to be in the Premier League? What for you actually happens here typically?
I mean, I think it would be massively the wrong thing to do, to change too much too quickly. I'm sure he's got his own view of how football should be played, and I'm sure that at least for a month or so he will stick pretty rigidly to that. Away at Forest is not easy. I think the way they were opened up in the first half would be a concern, but they didn't concede in the second half, so it may be that he was able to put things in place at half time that sort of checked the sort of Forest dominance. They got Villa at home next week, so their home form last season was, you know, what led to them having such a good season. They had, you know, I think the fixtures were pretty kind to them as well early on, that they got a lot of the weaker sides at home, and so they could build up that sense of the GTEC as a fortress. But Villa, I think, actually not at their best. It might not be a bad time to play Villa, that get them before they've sort of settled down. Yeah, Villa didn't look anything special on Saturday. The fact that Consa's going to be suspended, there's an opportunity there. But equally, Villa are a comfortable top half side. It's not going to be easy. And if Brentford don't win that, or don't even, yeah, maybe a draw is not too bad against Villa, but they've then got Sunderland the following week at the Stadium of Light. And that already looks like a relegation 6-pointer. And Sunderland, their first home game of the season could hardly have gone better. The atmosphere there will be incredible. That'll be a game that Sunderland will have targeted before the season. So, yeah, suddenly 3 games in, Brentford could be under a load of pressure. And then you're thinking, well, how long does this go? Do they cut their losses early?
Yeah.
Or does it drag on to November, December before they get rid of him? And you have the idea that he might stay for the full season or almost disappears off the table.
They spent 40-odd million on signing a player from Bournemouth. It's such a weird scenario where clubs who appear to be on a fairly similar level are signing players off each other for such significant sums at the moment. Is that just a statement of where the Premier League are? Like, if you're a Brentford fan, you're like, ooh, Bournemouth are selling us this player. They must not rate him.
Yeah, I think that would be my fear, certainly. It's one of those moves that it doesn't seem an obvious step up for Dango Watara. You know, he had a very good season last season. He showed he could play not just on the wing where we used to sing, but yeah, had a very good run through the middle. Clearly a good finisher. You'd look at that side and you'd think, yeah, Evan Nilsson, Cliver, Semenyo, that's not a bad forward line to be part of. Why are you making a sideways, if not slightly downward step? Maybe he's desperate to live in London. I mean, you do hear that of players that they sort of scorn the provinces. But I mean, Bournemouth, London's only a couple of hours, and you'd think a footballer would be able to manage that if that really is the issue. I find it hard to believe Brentford are offering massively more wages. So that's just one of those deals where I don't quite get it. And the only thing I can think of is he sees himself as a centre-forward, and he looks at Bournemouth and thinks, well, Evan Nielsen is going to be the centre forward, Clivert playing behind him, maybe Clivert then steps in if there is an injury, and he thinks, I don't want to be stuck on the wing, I want to show just how good I can be as the goal scorer. Maybe that's it, but it's, on the face of it, it seems a strange move. I agree.
Just a brief digression from the games themselves on Roy Keane. We were debating at the start of the show about his level of punditry and the detail that he goes into, Jonathan. And it's funny, for such an amazing player, and for a guy who I imagine Sunderland fans have, I don't know, do they have a soft spot for, from what he achieved initially, certainly as manager?
Definitely. I mean, you know, he took them from a hopeless position to promotion, and that season is one of the most remarkable turnarounds you'll ever see.
And he kept them in first season as well. He kept them up. It was the next season when he got a bit of money to spend, but on that it was...
Oh no, he spent money throughout. We shouldn't overlook how much money he wasted.
Fair enough. Like,
Sunderland had an enormous squad, and that caused some problems for the following decade. They were constantly chasing their tail, trying to cut costs.
It's kind of the lack of detail and like specific analysis of how a game is won and lost, or you know, how a midfield works. Is that ever jarring with you when it comes to Roy Keane? Because he talks in, not generalities, but there's a very distinctive way that he delivers a line where you get so much entertainment, Jonathan, but you might lack a bit of detail. But maybe people don't really care about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a punditry team is much like a football team, that you need a balance. So if he's on with the more sort of detailed people, that balance works really well. As I say, I didn't see any of the punditry yesterday, so I don't know what it was like yesterday. But if he's on with other people whose main skill is the capacity to craft a clever phrase, to sound, well, I'm sure to be quite sort of emotionally engaged in it, to be quite angry about things, then it can become a bit shouty and a bit annoying. But you know, Keane at his best is a compelling pundit. And if you have him alongside, say, a Jamie Carragher, who is doing the detailed stuff, that balance works really well. What you don't want sort of 3 data nerds there, but equally you don't want 3 people who think the game's all about yeah, blood and guts and thunder, yeah, and making big tackles.
On that side, he used to manage. What a start, Jonathan, for Sunderland. Mm. This Premier League stuff is easy. 3-0 at home to West Ham.
I found myself sitting at the United game yesterday thinking, nothing to be scared of for Sunderland here. We can beat these two. Which is obviously nonsense. No, it's a great start. And, yeah, is it Sunderland were good? Is it West Ham were bad? It could be either. It could be both. I think you have to say that the fixture list has been kind to Sunderland. That if you look last season, I think it was October the 5th before promoted team won a game. The previous season of September the 30th. So look, it's just good for football that a promoted team has won on the opening day. I think if you look back over history, the newly promoted sides, if they don't have 8 points from first five games, they don't stay up. So that's got to be the first target for any promoted side. Get the 8 points in five games. Now, partly that's obviously because your points are good. But partly I think it's about self-belief. And if you come into the season and you're getting battered every week, then suddenly every game seems impossible. If you win a couple of games, very quickly you start thinking, well, hang on, this lot aren't any better. Unless we can get a result here. I think if the stadium light becomes, the atmosphere on Saturday looked extraordinary. If it becomes a place that's used to winning, where that atmosphere becomes habitual, then there'll be other teams thinking, oh God, get out of here with a draw, might be all right. But the fixture list has been incredibly kind. That your West Ham, pretty poor season last season. I think a lot of doubts about Graham Potter. I don't think any of their signings particularly have excited people. I think the way that West Ham sort of fell apart in the last half hour suggests there's pretty major problems there. They then got Burnley away. Burnley finished 24 points above Sunderland last season, so you'd say they should be the better side, but equally, Sunderland have invested massively. You look at the two games between Sunderland and Burnley last season. Sunderland won 1-0 at the Stadium of Light and played them off the park. They're a much better team. Went to Burnley, had a very awkward first 20 minutes, and then actually controlled the rest of the game and missed two penalties in the last 10 minutes, or they'd have won it. So I don't think Sunderland fear Burnley. And if you're a newly promoted side, the other newly promoted sides, they're what you know. You think, well, that is a game where we could get points. Then Brentford are home. So you think, well, yeah, 9 points from three games and the run to Europe's on.
There you go. It was the first time since January 2001, I believe, that Sunderland have finished a Premier League weekend in the top two. So I was wondering, with their other title contenders this season, Jonathan, who did you on Friday afternoon have to win the Premier League this season? And am I right in saying it was Chelsea?
Yeah, it was, yeah. So it's beginning to reconsider that. The oddity of that game yesterday was the concern I had over them wasn't going forward. It was, is the goalkeeper good enough?
Yeah,
and I think the Eze ruled out goal. You would question Robert Sanchez on that. He gets away with it because of, I actually just thought it was a push, so I wasn't surprised it was ruled out. I was then surprised to see the explanation being this very technical thing. Maybe they think that the technicality that he was within a metre of the wall, that's undisputable, so it's just black and white. But the fact is, he shoved Caicedo, wasn't it? It was Caicedo, Mark Gay shoved Caicedo out of the way. I just think that's a foul. Like, it's not the worst example of it you'll see, but I don't like the idea that free kicks are basically sort of big wrestling matches and who can shove who out of the way.
Yeah.
So, when I saw the replay, I was like, that's a foul. And then suddenly, 5 minutes later, you're getting this complex explanation that just looks like, I'm sure not something that anybody on the pitch thought of. If Chelsea players were appealing for something, they were appealing as a pushing Caicedo. They weren't going, actually, he's only 87 centimetres from the wall, so I think you'll find that's going to be ruled out. That seemed very odd. But I think it was rightly ruled out for all the disappointment people felt. The injuries they've had at the back, I think, are a problem for Chelsea. That's, Fofana, Badiashil, Colwell, a couple of others got your centre backs have got minor injuries. They should be back within a week or two. But those three, I think Fofana should be back in a week or two. But they're all longish term injuries. So I did think maybe they need another centre back. But I thought going forward they'd be fine. And actually they were incredibly flat.
Yeah.
And that I think is the big disappointment for Chelsea. That Chelsea fans got very frustrated with Enzo Maresca last season. because of the flatness of so many displays. And I sort of slightly was of the opinion that if they'd had a better centre forward, if they'd had, you know, a real sort of predatory striker, and I say this with a degree of sympathy to Nicholas Jackson, because I think he was asked to do an impossible job. I think he was overpromoted. It's not his fault. He should have been brought three more slowly. He arrived at Chelsea, having played 16 games in La Liga. And I don't like the sort of mockery and sort of finger pointing at him. But equally, had they had a more clinical striker, I think there's a lot of games where they'd been ahead within 20 minutes, half an hour. Suddenly, the atmosphere of the game changes. You're passing the ball about if you're a Chelsea fan, you're watching them passing the ball about, think it's fine. We're 1-0 up. That's 3 points. When you're doing that at 0-0, it's quite frustrating. Equally, opponents will have to come out. There'll be space behind them. Something that Nicholas Jackson will be very good at exploiting. Look at the pace they've got in wide areas. And I thought, as soon as they start scoring that early goal, because they've got Liam Delap or because they've got Xhao Pedro, they'll be fine. But they still couldn't score that goal. And you look at Cole Palmer and you think, well, it's 8 months since he scored a goal from open play in the league, which doesn't make any sense. If you think how well he played at the Club World Cup. So, I mean, look, it's early. I'm sure things will click. I was slightly surprised by the starting lineup, that I thought the strength of Chelsea would be playing that really aggressive three in the middle, which would mean Cole Palmer playing on the right. So playing Enzo as number 10, obviously quite a deep lying number 10, with Caicedo and one other. I mean, Lavia obviously is also injured again. But Reece James played very well there in the Club World Cup final. Maybe the thinking was against Palace, they don't need quite that aggression, quite that block. But I'm just not convinced Cole Palmer's as effective in the middle as he is coming in from the right.
Was the reason you vouched for Chelsea before a ball was kicked, was it influenced by the Club World Cup and winning it? Or is it a feeling that they actually do have the best squad? Because it feels like the season of top squads. Because you look at Arsenal, Liverpool and Manchester City, there's a ridiculous array of quality available to come off the bench, let alone start.
Yeah, I mean, my thinking was, I looked at Liverpool and I thought, it's a lot of changes. There could be issues with balance. And I think that is true. And, you know, they were pretty fortunate to get away with it against Bournemouth on Friday. If you're relying on Chiesa to score with 2 minutes to go to get you ahead, then things have gone wrong. You look at the second Semenyo goal. Why have they got 8 players in the box? They're 2-1 up. Why are there 8 players within, or maybe not in the box, within 25 yards of the Bournemouth goal? Why is there not a player sitting in front of Van Dijk and Konate? Really basic thing. I know that the Gravenberg was suspended, but Endo's played that role. What's going on? Why is he not just there? Or why has McAllister not filled that space if Endo's been dragged out? Really weird structural issue there. I'm sure they'll sort it out, but my thinking was, first month or so of the season, that could be a problem. I'm not convinced by either fullback yet. I think Kirkez looked really shaky on Friday, having been pretty shaky in the Community Shield. Frimpong, I think, is a good player, but his link-up with Salah, it'll come, I'm sure, but it's not there yet. So I thought all those changes, there's a doubt about Liverpool. Arsenal, I still just don't fully trust. I think there's weird sort of issues with... they always seem to be involved in some kind of psychodrama, which I don't think is ever healthy. There's a real sort of tension about them. Although, you know, they did very well at Old Trafford yesterday to get the result, having not, as Arteta said, didn't play particularly well. This time, the set play, which I think became a crutch they relied on too much last season, yesterday got them the goal that they needed. And then, I mean, Raya had to make 7 saves, which is not ideal, but fundamentally they defended pretty well. And then City, you know, 9 changes this year, you know, 4 in January, another 5 in the summer in terms of, you know, major players. I just thought that was a lot of change. And I was thinking, why is nobody talking about Chelsea? Why are Chelsea people's fourth favourites? You look at them, they've got a great squad. Maresca showed in the Club World Cup final, he can produce tactical plans for big games. The big problem last season for me was the lack of a centre-forward. They now got 2 good centre-forwards. All right, Delap is young and still learning, but Xhao Pedro, yeah, I think was a very... I know he only scored six non-penalty goals, I think, last season, but still, you know, he's a proper, clever player who scores goals. Some reservations over the keeper, but I sort of thought they'd sort that out. I mean, I sort of slightly surprised that conversations with Donnarumma haven't gone further than they seem to have. I thought that the squad, they've just got such depth. Why are we not talking about Chelsea? Well, I mean, you know, it's early days, but maybe yesterday we saw that they just, for some reason, don't quite have that spark, and they struggle to overcome mid-table sides at home.
They are very young as a group. I'm just looking at the ages of all the players there. I think Neto at 25 might be the oldest of the team, maybe Cucurella. It's an 18-year-old centre-back, it's an 18-year-old sub coming off. We've seen them spend $1 billion developing this squad, and very few finished articles. You'd say Fernandes and Caicedo were supposed to be, but even both of them, you would hope, still have some development to go. Is there room for just an old, wise head somewhere along the way?
Yeah, I'm sure they wish Thiago Silva was 5 years younger, or 10 years younger. I mean, what age is he now? But 540, but yeah. But possibly. I think you do need that balance, and possibly they are too young. But equally, you know, footballers are getting younger. Yeah, they're like policemen. the peak age of a footballer seems to have dropped from 27 to 23.
That's true.
Certainly in terms of price. I think it's such a dynamic, aggressive, quick game these days that players in their early 20s are what you need, which makes development really difficult. I don't think it's a healthy situation. I think players really need 4 or 5 years to develop both sort of mentally and tactically. And yeah, what do you do with players in the late 20s? You can't really write them off. And yet we seem to be doing that. And yeah, I think two or three scattered in. I mean, you look at what Van Dijk does for Liverpool at 34. That's a hugely valuable role, even if at times he can look, when the structure falls apart around him, he can look slightly cumbersome.
What's the most urgent signing needed among the title contenders? So feels like Liverpool need another centre-back, Jonathan, even in reserve, because that's the menu goal you were talking about. It was like, yeah, where was the midfield cover and why were so many players in advance? But Semenyo just kept running and running and running, and the players kept retreating to the point where Semenyo had almost too many options. He had two players to his left. He probably could have passed them, but he went himself instead. So it feels like Liverpool need a centre-half. Feels like Arsenal maybe need another option on the left side of attack outside of Gabriel Martinelli. Is there anything that's urgently required? Man City have brought a lot of players in. Maybe that's enough for them. Who out of all those clubs that have hopes of winning the Premier League really actually need to do more business before the window closes?
Yeah, I think City, you've got to let the dust settle a bit before we can really judge them. There's been so much change already. Slightly baffled by what's going on with the goalkeeping situation there, but maybe they do think James Trafford is the future and Edison's not.
He was good. Trafford was quite good against Wolves. His distribution.
Had a great season last season as well. I mentioned the two penalties on the miss in the last 10 minutes. Well, he saved them both, and he outside Wilson Isidore. I don't doubt he's a good keeper, but he's 22.
Yeah.
Slightly surprised by... And I think Edison's level maybe had dropped a bit last season, but it seems a bold decision to have taken. I think you're absolutely right about Arsenal, that they need somebody a bit more reliable than Martinelli on the left. I suppose they've got Madueke, who could play on the left, although yeah, we've been used to seeing him on the right. But the reports of their interest in Eze made complete sense to me, and I'm slightly surprised they haven't pushed that a bit harder, because I think Eze is available if they went 65-70, and I think that would be worth it. I think he's a great player, and I think he would, A, you know, he works incredibly hard, but B, he's a real goal threat. So that would be something for them to look at. At Liverpool, I think they are short of a centre back. I know they brought in the 18-year-old last week, yeah, but presumably not going to be relying on him, Leone. But I think that goal actually is, I don't think you can really blame the centre backs. I think that's you've got somebody quick running at you, unless you just go and foul him. What do? You know, you need the holding midfielder. So maybe it's actually holding midfielder they need. And I sort of thought that last season, and Gravenberch did it incredibly well. But you are relying on Gravenberch, A, maintaining his form, and B, staying fit and not being suspended. So I sort of feel Liverpool need a holding midfielder. You have a Fabinho replacement for two seasons now. So maybe that is something. And Chelsea need a goalkeeper. I mean, I know they've got about 15 on their books, but maybe get a good one.
Yeah. It is true. There's some very curious goalkeeping decisions in general happening at the moment, seemingly. But obviously, these teams have like huge faith in certain players, which is what I mean about James Trafford. Conversely, which team are you really worried about this season? Like, the reason I'm asking these overall questions is that it feels like you go into a false sense of security after one round of games. So, you know, like, oh, Man City have a right. Like, Man City are going to be unbelievable because they just trounced the Wolves, but maybe not necessarily, and so on. Are any of those title contenders slash clubs hoping to qualify for Europe that you're actually worried about this season that will underperform?
Well, I think Liverpool and City will both be concerned by how open they were. I mean, City obviously overwhelmed Wolves pretty quickly, but that first sort of 15, 20 minutes till the first goal, Wolves threatened to open up a couple of times. So that's not right yet. And I think we saw that at the Club World Cup, the way Al Hilal opened them up. So there's work to be done there. I think both Liverpool and City have tightening up to be done. Chelsea have loosening up to be done. Arsenal, I felt, generally were pretty scratchy and slightly got away with it. So I don't think any of the four were entirely convincing. I mean, three wins and a draw between them, so it's fine. It's not a huge problem. I think Villa would be really disappointed with how they played against the Newcastle side, who you'd maybe would have thought were a little bit vulnerable. If you got at them the first 10, 15 minutes, given the summer they've had, Woodheads have dropped. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know, Villa losing the lone players. And I know they brought in Guessin, who can play anywhere across the front three. So in terms of a body, he fulfills that role that Rashford and Asensio performed. But he hasn't got the glamour of them. Whether he's got the ability then, we'll find out. But I feel things have gone a bit flat with Villa. I think there's also maybe still a hangover from the way they failed to qualify for the Champions League. The fact that, you know, all they had to do was not get beat at Old Trafford, which, you know, plenty of teams found it quite easy to do last season, and they somehow managed to lose at Old Trafford. They maybe will be concerned by that. I think Spurs obviously started well, but you can't read too much in the game against Burnley. Newcastle probably were better than we were expecting them to be. I mean, they probably should have won that game. They were a bit flat as well, and I think, unfortunately, there were the two very good chances, one for Langer, one for Anthony Gordon, where you sort of thought, oh yeah, Isak would have scored them. Which, of course, is nonsense because all players miss chances. But a Langer put clean through early on never looked comfortable. You know, his weight distribution never looked right. And if Isak had missed that, he would have missed it in a more graceful and convincing way. And then the Anthony Gordon header, and it's not Anthony Gordon's fault, he's not 6'4", but Alexander Isak is 6'4", and he's good in the air. So not an easy chance at all, but Isak would have had a better chance. So those two opportunities sort of exposed what not having Isak cost them. But fundamentally, they were a better side than Villa, I thought. I thought if either side was going to win it, it was going to be them. So maybe a bit of frustration they didn't create more against 10 men. So, yeah, I don't think anybody at the top, I don't think anybody has really convinced, I mean, apart from Sunderland, I don't think anybody has really convinced, but you wouldn't expect them to on the first weekend.
Are Forest going to be good again this year? There was a transfer saga involving Spurs with one of their best players who doubled down and signed a new deal with them. And they've started to sign some players, and they also have a brilliant defence. Like, they've got as good a centre-back partnership maybe as there is. We'll see over the rest of the season if they can maintain the levels they were at last season.
Yeah, well, on Friday I was boldly saying, there's no way Chris Wood has a good season like he had last season. If he gets 12, he'll have done well. And there he is, just knocking in two in the first half, looking brilliant again. So, yeah, I thought there'd be a drop-off, but there was no sign of it on Sunday. I thought they'd miss Alanga. I think his directness really suited them. But, yeah, they seem not to miss him at all. So let's see when the European games start. Let's see when they're playing harder teams than Brentford. But 3-0 up by half-time, you can't really complain at that. I think there has to be realism, though. I think they have to understand that last season was exceptional. They're not going to be challenging the Champions League again. And as long as that awareness is there and they don't get frustrated if they're finishing 9th or 10th, that 9th or 10th is still actually pretty good, then that'll be fun. Brighton, actually, I think, were pretty disappointing. I think maybe they were the biggest underperformers of all. I know they've got a funny relationship with Fulham, but they don't really get good results against Fulham for odd reasons. But I thought they were they were pretty poor on Saturday. And yet again, not holding on to a lead, which has become a bit of a Fabian Hertzler trait. So maybe there's a bit of concern there. But yeah, I mean, what does that mean? They're going to finish 14th rather than 9th? You know, it's not a huge worry, I wouldn't have thought.
The 13th of December, Jonathan. That's the date of the first derby, I believe. Sunderland, Newcastle. Is that a time when I would vouch for you being one of the have the ability to be one of the most objective journalists out there? Does that go out the window on that day? Is that a difficult game to report on?
I hate reporting on Sunderland. Full stop.
Right.
I try and avoid it if I possibly can.
Really?
I reported on the League Cup final in 2014, and genuinely was one of the worst days I've ever had.
Oh, Man City, wasn't it?
Yeah, when Sunderland were ahead, I couldn't write anything because I didn't want to tempt fate. Which obviously is a ludicrously arrogant position to take, as if fate's going to go, you know what, Sunderland were going to win this game, but he's written a positive Sunderland intro before half time, so we're going to mess them up. I don't like doing it. I have reported on a couple of derbies before, and it's not nice, not pleasant. You've got to try and... It's a bit like when you have to umpire your own cricket team. You've got to sort of... to take a part of your brain and put it to the back and sort of bring the professional side to the front. But I don't like doing it at all. I think the last Sunderland game I reported on was the Papa John's final, because it was during COVID, so the only way I could get into Wembley was to report on it.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a game I didn't care about until Sunderland took the lead. Again, it should be said, fourth tier Tranmere, and then spent the remaining half hour of the game sort of twitching and kicking and kind of just having an awful afternoon. I try and avoid writing about them. What I would say for that game is that Sunderland are going to be missing 5 or 6 players because of the Cup of Nations by then, which is a problem they could have over the winter, that they've got a lot of players who play for African sides.
And you also have the in-law derby as well, Sunderland Spurs, to deal with this season.
Yeah, I mean, that's not so bad, because you just sort of, anything Sunderland get against Spurs is a bonus. So, yeah. But yeah, so I will have that, yeah.
Jonathan, great start to the season. Thanks a mil.
Cheers, thank you.
Cheers.
Maybe Morgan Gibbs-White did want to stay after all. Maybe he wasn't forced by the owner, because he had a great game against Brentford.
Oh, well,
the level of assists he has is like historical for Forest in the Premier League.
You wouldn't sign the new deal under duress.
Well, that was the whole joke. That was the running joke of the whole summer, was that when he announced that he would stay and he was on the pitch and Marinakis was just out of shot, gun to the back of the head, tell them you're happy. Like that episode of The Simpsons, The Mafia. But he obviously got a nice pay for himself. I was convinced this guy was going to Spurs. I remember speaking to a Spurs fan this summer at a birthday party in a pub, and he was like, all right, well, we have Gibbs-White, so then we're going to add. Like, that's how close it felt.
Spurs were good. I said Spurs would be good. Spurs were good.
Yeah, one game. Yeah.
Taking my lap of honour here.
Yeah, Richarlison.
Just in case they screw up after
double.
This.
First goal was like really well taken, because difficult half bounce volley inside the box. But the second goal, another good connection with Mohamed Kudus. That looks good from the start.
So the
spectacular finish by Richarlison.
The Ebrecht Eze thing.
Yeah.
There's a good chance he might go there.
Yeah. Speaking with a few Spurs fans in the know as well, who are very confident that Eze will choose the white side of North London.
That would be very exciting for Spurs. They've got a
who do you think he'd... What decision would be better for SA, do you think? Spurs or Arsenal?
Arsenal are closer to being a Champions League contender.
He mightn't be as important.
You'd be the legend of Spurs in that team.
So it could be Grealish, Villa, Grealish, Man City.
You think SA would be more impactful for Arsenal? I think that I think that he wouldn't become the automaton, like you get the ball and you keep possession, whatever you do, don't take any risks. Arthur's asking, what would he need to do to become a Spurs legend?
Yeah.
Score 5 to 7 goals that's some amazing dribbles.
Big philosophical question that the theme of Arthur's questioning this morning is, what does it mean to do something? It's like Florian Wirtz, 100 million plus player. What does that mean? And it's a good question, because it's open-ended. We may never be able to answer it, but we can check in with it. And the other thing as well is, there was a lot of goodwill towards Chris Wood last season, wasn't it? It was kind of like, verging on the condescending, was like, oh, fair play to Chris.
Because
he kind of looks like an everyman. You know, he looks like he could work in IT in an office job. He's a very normal looking guy.
Construction?
No, office. He's a soft face, soft features. He was like...
He's a big lad.
He was like, He could kill you, but a lot of big lads in offices around the country.
Kill your granny.
And the world. I don't know if he John Giles it. I don't know, but maybe he will from that start of the season. But he was like a good middling Premier League striker. He was the first Newcastle signing under the Saudi money when they got him from Burnley. And when he went to Forest, there was like, I think, a collective shrug of the shoulders. So last season, great campaign. Bit like Marcus Stewart for Ipswich, turn of the century. It was like, oh, that's class, fair play to you. But if he does it a second season, what territory does he get into? Oh, he was a seriously good Premier League striker. Seriously good. I think you have to do it more than one season.
Oh, yeah.
To be remembered.
The
cruelty of football.
Yeah. Well, they're all remembered now.
Forest fans will remember him forever.
I think Forest...
Outside of that.
Sorry, the reason I was asking about Forest, their defence last season, nobody's come in to sign those two centre-backs the way Bournemouth's three of their four have been picked off by the best teams in the world. And yet... Those two centre-backs. There was, I see people are raving about Arsenal centre-backs yesterday, but I thought they had their fill of it from
two lads. Thought Gabriel particularly started dodgily.
There was one lucky bit where it was like, if he goes down here, you're in trouble.
Mm.
If you clip his heels here, which is kind of a bit fluky if you don't. But then I suppose, look, that's the quality of the player that they recover from that.
Yeah. I have to say, I don't know about you, I'm very excited for this season, more so than the last couple of campaigns. Like a lot of the times, I remember last season feeling, oh, it's back already. So I wasn't ready for this. I think the absence of an international tournament is huge.
And the fact that we knew what was going to happen with the three teams relegated until, I mean, obviously, Villa screwed it up on the last day of the season, which keeps coming up.
It might have helped that we had... there was nothing to play for towards the end of the season, basically, so we could kind of have to be like, all right, we'll move on to something else. So we're back now properly. And the amount of business being done, I feel like, you know, gone are the days of the dildo in the ear, Sky Sports News, where it's frantic. I was like, I know, clubs are only kind of signing players, you know, sporadically and like 4 weeks apart and kind of under the radar. But now it feels like it's deadline day for about 4 weeks, the amount of this stuff happening.
It does. I do suspect there's a lot more business still to be done.
Oh, definitely.
You know, Isaac Guehi, like at a very high level. Not just players coming in on loan who are random moonshots.